Coming events is at CranertCenter.com.
Up next, our look at the weather. A low-pressure center over central Oklahoma will dominate our weather over the next several days. The Midwest will see rain today and into tomorrow as a result. The rain could mix with or change to snow northwest of the Illinois River, with light snow accumulations possible. Light snow accumulations will also be possible over northern sections tomorrow night. High temperatures today will range from the mid-30s across eastern Iowa to the mid-50s in western Kentucky. Low temperatures tonight will range from the mid-20s across eastern Iowa to the low 40s in western Kentucky. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon will see showers and periods of drizzle. Expect a high in the low 40s. The wind will be out of the east at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, rain is likely. The temperature will hold near steady in the low 40s. The wind light and from the southeast. After midnight, the wind will be from the southwest. Tomorrow, cloudy with a chance of rain in the morning. Look for a high of 48. The wind will be out of the west from 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-30s and a light southwest wind. Thursday, partly sunny with a high in the mid-40s. The wind from the north at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Thursday night and Friday, mostly cloudy. The low Thursday night will be in the low 30s. Expect a high Friday in the upper 30s. The outlook for Friday night, mostly cloudy with a low in the upper 20s. At noon central time, skies across Illinois and Indiana were cloudy with several locations reporting rain. At Rockford, it was 38, also 38 at Bloomington. In Chicago at O'Hare, 39 degrees. Mattoon reported 43 degrees. At Carbondale, it was 47. South Bend reported 36 degrees at the top of the hour. In Lafayette, 41. In Indianapolis, it was 45. And at Terre Haute, 46. Willard Airport reported a cloudy sky at the top of the hour with fog. The temperature, 42. The dew point, 40. The relative humidity, 92%. The wind out of the east at 12. The barometric pressure, 29.97. And falling in at 1239, 40 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. Nanotechnology is the science of the very small. Nanoscientists manipulate matter at the scale of atoms and molecules, often ending up with materials that behave very differently than their macroscale counterparts. University of Missouri St. Louis chemist George Gokel was recently named director of the university's Center for Nanoscience. Veronique LaCapra spoke with Gokel about some of the research going on at the center and the future of nanotechnology.
The Nanoscience Center encompasses really quite a broad range of things because nanoscience itself encompasses a broad range of possibilities. So we have people who are doing research that borders on medicine, and we have people working on things that border on materials science. The new associate director of the center is Eric Majoub, who's in the physics department, and his interest and research effort is actually developing very high output, very low weight batteries for automobiles. Hybrid cars are great, but if we could have batteries that were of low enough weight and high enough output, we could charge them up at home and really get some distance out of cars.
What do you see as kind of the most exciting future applications of nanotechnology?
Well, I'm interested in the possibility of drug delivery and curative processes. Our own chancellor, you may know, is actually working with someone to develop what they call nanobombs. And these are materials that they would deliver in proximity to a tumor and then thermally excite. They would explode and destroy the tumor, but their explosion wouldn't have such a deleterious effect on the surrounding tissue.
Are there nanotechnologies that are already being used today that people might encounter in their everyday lives?
Yes, there certainly are. People are talking about nanocircuits, for example. There are many kinds of sensors that people are trying to develop, especially things that could detect, say, airborne toxins that could be put in the atmosphere by a terrorist, or airborne toxins, for example, in a hospital.
So are those things that are already in use now or that are under development?
Yes, both of those, really. Many sensors are actually practical, and many are still goals.
So we're developing all these new technologies. A lot of people probably don't really understand them or maybe don't even know they're out there. What about risks? What's being done to assess and maybe regulate those?
That's a very good question. As with all new technologies and developments, there needs to be a close examination of what the risks are. It's just not known whether some of these small materials, if they get airborne, would have dire consequences. And if you don't know how much is dangerous, you don't know how to regulate it. And you can regulate it, but it's foolish to regulate it unless you can actually detect it. And so we're working to try to figure out how to detect it so that we can know how much to say you can't have more than.
I mean, should we be worried? It sounds like, you know, the pace of our ability to understand these technologies or assess their risks isn't really keeping pace with the rate at which things are being developed, new technologies are being developed.
Well, what's really of concern, I think, as much as anything, is during the manufacturing processes as these things evolve, what's the worker exposure? What kind of limits will be placed on these things in packaging? What limits will be placed on how they can be stored? Does temperature or light affect them? And those have to be handled, I think, on a case-by-case basis. But we're very much aware of those issues.
That's George Gokel. He's the director of the Center for Nanoscience at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. He spoke with Veronique LaCapra in St. Louis. This is the Afternoon Magazine. It's 12:45. During the holidays, beer manufacturers roll out seasonal brews. And now, in addition to Ebenezer Ale and Santa's Private Reserve, there's a relative newcomer for Hanukkah, a chocolatey porter from a microbrewer in Portland, Oregon. Dina Prechep reports.
A small craft brewery, Lompoc, in North Portland, produces about 3,000 barrels a year. Dave Fleming is the head brewer.
Now we've got the water coming in, the auger on, and then we have the mill going, and that's grinding. If you want to come up and take a look.
This time of year, customers want something a little festive. So a few years back, Lompoc came up with a new beer.
We had a gentleman here, Sam Orlansky, working with us, and he's Jewish, and he wanted to make a Hanukkah brew. So we thought it was a great idea. We already had 6 Christmas beers going anyhow, so why couldn't we have a 7th one for Hanukkah?
Lompoc ended up with a chocolate rye porter called 8 Malty Nights. It's become one of their more popular winter beers. And they're not alone. A few others, like Schmaltz Brewery, are also bringing Jewish beers to market. But they're not the first.
The story of Jews brewing beer, at least in recorded history, begins really far back at the Babylonian exile.
Marnie Davis is the author of Jews and Booze and teaches history at Georgia State University. She says that even though beer is never mentioned in the Hebrew Bible, it is kosher. And Jews have brewed it all through history, from Persia to Europe and into America.
Central European Jews who found themselves in cities where, A, there weren't a lot of Germans, and, B, there wasn't a brewery yet. I found several examples of these Jews actually founding breweries.
One of the biggest was New York's Rheingold Brewery, founded by Samuel Liebman. But, Davis says, for the most part, Jewish breweries cropped up in smaller non-German cities, places like Denver or Anaheim. Unfortunately, even the most successful of these breweries had to empty out their kegs in 1919. Well, at least officially.
The most important Jewish beer entrepreneurs during Prohibition were the bootleggers, the gangsters. They were operating with Irish and Italian immigrants. These sort of inter-ethnic crime syndicates really helped to maintain the presence of alcohol and of beer in particular in American life.
After Prohibition, small Jewish breweries, like small breweries everywhere, were edged out by the big guys. It's only in the last few years, with the microbrewery revival, that we're starting to see them again. So does this long history mean that we've had it all wrong? That Jews really are the people of the hops? Davis says beer isn't particularly Jewish. But it is a part of Jewish life.
Beer is one of the ways that Jews can become part of the culture that they're in, and they can do it as Persians. They could do so as German Americans in the beer gardens of Cincinnati. And they could do it today as producers of cheeky beers that are coming out of craft breweries right as we speak.
Cheeky beers like Eight Malty Nights, which is doing great, says brewer Dave Fleming.
It really worked well. We were very impressed, and it was one of the hits of the year. This will be the third year we've made it.
Lompoc has already brewed 60 kegs for the holiday season. And, perhaps even more importantly, it goes great with Hanukkah latkes. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchett in Portland, Oregon.
On December 31st, WILL will be halfway through the fundraising year. Our goal during the month of December is to raise $500,000. If we work together, we can reach that goal. Every gift can make a difference, and your contribution to WILL is tax-deductible if you contribute by December 31st. Please support the programs you enjoy. Give online at willpledge.org. And thanks.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 20th of December, 2011. It's the birthday of the physicist